Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Two of the most anticipated drama series this spring premiere next week and will feature both over the next hour. First comes Hemlock Grove, launching a week from today via Netflix, about two suspects in a murder case out to clear their names and nab the killer. One catch, one suspect may be a werewolf. Brian McGreevy, adapting the series from his best-selling novel, joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. Second is Defiant, sci-fi's vision of a rebuilding future Earth out to be colonized by aliens. There's a special connection here. Defiant tracks in tandem with a video game with the same name released 2 weeks ago. Find out about Defiant's Monday night debut and where both game and TV series travel from there next half hour with executive producer Michael Nankin. For our second hour, we check out Perspectors, the Weather Channel's sleeper series of the year, with executive producer Sarah Presta, live from Denver, and scope out World Fishing Network via programming director Aaron Rodriguez, live from Toronto, Canada. Also ahead, the answer to our classic trivia question of the week, and we remember TV's wackiest funny man, Jonathan Winters. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Thank you for making this part of your Friday afternoon, and welcome to the show that covers the world of television. We have a terrific 2 hours in store for you, four wonderful guests, and we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes is you calling us with your question and comment to any of our guests. The number you use is 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. The number has been anywhere. You're catching us across the country, around the world, here on Blog Talk Radio. Another way you get involved is our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Our good friend Rick Webb from Philadelphia is in the room. So use the phone, use the room. Either way, we would love to hear from you. We'll give you plenty of time to get your questions in, either by the phone or the chat room. You can also have other people listen to the show with you right now by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon somewhere on the Blog Talk Radio screen. Follow the instructions, and other people can hear the show with you right now. We hope to have Brian McGreevy, the author of Hemlock Grove, coming up, and if he doesn't show up in the next few minutes, we will go right to Los Angeles and speak with Defiant's executive producer, Michael Nankin. That's all happening after this news note. Jonathan Winters, the improvisational wacky comedian who headlined variety series in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, has passed away at the age of 87. News of his death came out this afternoon, a day after Winters died at his California home from natural causes. Winters had a variety show on NBC in the 1950s, CBS for 2 years in the 60s, and the syndicated Wacky World series in the 1970s. When Winters didn't do variety, often playing such roles as grandmotherly Maud Frickett, Winters displayed his comedic talents on talk shows or sitcom guest roles, including his turn opposite Robin Williams on Mork and Mindy, or his 1991 Emmy-winning role on David's Rules on ABC. His TV career also included voicing Papa Smurf on The Smurfs, and a dramatic effort as Billiards great Fax Brown on the Twilight Zone episode, A Game of Pool, in 1961. Once again, Jonathan Winters passing on at the age of 87. I'll have more to say about Winters and his magnificent TV career in the next hour. We are weighing Brian McGreevy from Hemlock Grove, so as we wait for him, we will go live to Los Angeles and we'll speak with one of the executive producers of another anticipated series coming up next week, Monday night, 9 p.m. to be exact. It's Sci-Fi's Defiance. Joining us live from L.A., an internet radio exclusive, Michael Nankin. Michael, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
What's the mood among your fellow cast and crew about how Defiance is going to do starting Monday night?
I think we're all very nervous. You know, we've been working on it solidly for the better part of a year, and we're all so close to it, we can't tell. We're just, waiting to see what the world thinks of our work.
Well, this is going to be a very different sci-fi series from anything before it because this is connected directly to a video game of the same name that premiered 2 weeks ago. Have any of you heard what the reaction to the video game has been and how has it played into what you're doing?
I think it's been good. I haven't been able to get any official numbers, only anecdotal stories. Like my wife popped her head into a video game store yesterday and asked for Defiance, and I said they were sold out. So I take that as a good sign. And there was a new trailer that came up on YouTube today, which had a lot of comments from people who were enjoying the game and couldn't wait for the show. So not to jinx anything, it seems good so far.
Tell us about how this show came to be, how this became a joint project between your team and the people at Trion who made the game, and how it all came together.
Well, the inception of the project happened before I came on board, so I can't really speak too much to its genesis. You know, both the game and the show were in place when I was hired. But what I can talk about is that, you know, we spent a lot of time with Tryon and the writers of the show creating what we called crossover events, where things that would happen in the game would lead you to the show. For example, the two lead characters that people will see in our pilot on Monday have been in the game for 2 weeks. And just before the show airs, they will leave the game, enter the world of the show. And so we created, you know, a number of characters who would switch back and forth between the two mediums and events that would happen in the world of Defiance in both places.
Michael, I believe we have a call. We'll see if this is our other guest for the hour, Brian McGreevy at Henlock Grove. Let's see. Hello, you're on Tomorrow We Televise. What's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Brian McGreevy, and I am calling from the island of Manhattan.
Hello, Brian. And, of course, Brian is the author of Henlock Grove, which is a week from today going to become a new series on Netflix, the second original series that program of adventure has produced this year. So, Michael, we're going to say goodbye to you for a little while. We're going to bring you back at the top, at the bottom of the hour, okay?
Good luck, Brian.
Thank you.
That's Michael Natkin, executive producer of Defiance. That premieres Monday night at 9 o'clock on Sci-Fi. And now we are joined live for here in New York by the author of Henlock Grove and the creator of the new Netflix series that premieres a week from today, Brian McGreevy. Brian, great to have you.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm glad that we finally worked our way through the technical mishaps.
Absolutely. Just for those who don't know, Brian was scheduled to be on our show on Monday, and because of a technical glitch, we couldn't get him on, but we're finally delighted to have him here. Brian, after your novel was published 2 years ago, were there any thoughts about, hey, this could make a good television series?
Well, you know, there actually the chronology was we made the deal for the series after the book had been sold, but prior to publication. And the way it worked out, actually, I was handing off the final copy edits for the manuscript as the paperwork from Netflix was being drawn up.
Why do you think Netflix decided we're going to make this a TV series? What about the novel fascinated them to go ahead?
Well, in general, I would say that the novel as a form lends itself to adaptation as a series better than it does to film. It's just something that we've seen less of historically because of the pilot model. But with the straight-to-series model, I'm pretty sure we're going to be seeing a lot more of it. I mean, that Netflix would greenlight it the series was one of the things that made them most attractive to us.
There's one interesting thing about doing a show straight to series, and a lot more people are trying to do it that way. Obviously, you don't go with a pilot. Number two, you get the chance to do 13 episodes the way you want to. But by the same token, you don't get, in the case of Netflix, you don't get the feedback until people actually see all the episodes available at one time. What do you think, as a writer who is adapting your own work for television, how does that make you feel? How does that affect your creative process?
Well, that certainly doesn't bother me because, you know, with the exception of readers whose input I knew that I specifically valued and sought out, I wasn't writing the book with audience feedback, which I believe can be a double-edged sword, especially in this genre where you require the dramatic stakes that major characters and characters that audience members are ideally going to get attached to can be in mortal danger with the actual threat that they die. And so I think that it's to the disservice of the product if you're making decisions based on audience sentimentality.
Brian McGreevy is the author of the best-selling novel Henlock Grove. It came out 2 years ago, and next Friday it becomes a 13-episode television series, the second original one released by Netflix this year. It's available on both smart TVs and on personal computers from Netflix.com. And Brian joins us here in New York. an interview exclusive this half hour on Smartly Televised. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York. Happy to have you aboard wherever you're listening to us on Blog Talk Radio. And we invite you to be part of the conversation. Give us a call at 1-646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name, as guests 1251 and 1254 are doing. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we'll be rejoined in Los Angeles by Michael Natkin, one of the executive producers of another major show premiering this coming week, Defiant, Monday night at 9 o'clock on Sci-Fi. Once Netflix gave you the go-ahead to make this a series, did you insist on becoming an executive producer, or did they and Gaumont, the production company, decide, hey, you should be part of this in a big way?
You know, I was actually the first executive producer when I had the manuscript. That was one of my prerequisites for whoever I ended up working with on the book-to-film adaptation. At that point, we hadn't even decided whether or not it was going to be a film or TV series. But for me, because I had already been working in that industry for a number of years as, you know, a studio writer for hire, it just seemed to me that there wasn't really a reason to sell the novel unless I was actively involved.
And how much creative freedom has Netflix and Gaumont given you to shape the show the way you want?
A huge amount.
Can you describe it beyond huge? How is it magnified on the screen?
You know, it's funny, there's all this anxiety of Netflix using quote-unquote big data to micromanage the process, and it's quite the opposite, as a matter of fact. They're definitely using the data they have access to pick the projects that they buy and to pick the creative people who are going to run those projects. But beyond that, they're exceptionally hands-off, much more so than a traditional network.
For you, adapting this novel into a 13-hour, 13-part television series where you're dealing with other producers, you're dealing with writers, you're dealing with actors, what's the biggest challenge you had in making this program happen?
Well, for me personally, probably one of the biggest challenges was just inexperience with physical production. To that end, there were a number of other executive producers on the show, most notably Eli Roth, who have been quite experienced with physical production. So I would say my own obligations ended up being much more towards the writing end of things, along with my screenwriting partner, Lee Shipman, that, you know, we were really taking charge of the writer's room, and so other creative EPs were much more responsible for the execution.
We had Bo Willimon, the co-creator and executive producer of House of Cards, Netflix's first original series, with us 2 months ago. And one of the things he noted was the fact that he was able to have a great relationship not only with the writers but with the key actors, Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright in his case. What kind of relationship did you end up building with your writers, with people like Eli, who directed the first episode, as well as your stars?
Well, I think that show lead Bill Skarsgård and I share a hangover today after the night we had last night in Williamsburg. So we formed a pretty close relationship. It was also it was a tremendous opportunity to work with Landon Liberon as well, who he plays the character of Peter. These are both exceptionally talented young guys who they have a deceptive CV, respectively. They're both quite experienced in the industry, despite their ages. And I mean, I would say that you know, it was a very close, fruitful, collaborative relationship.
For people who haven't read Hemlock Grove or haven't heard a lot of the buzz about it, or even haven't seen the posters here in New York all over the bus and subways, tell us about the plot and how it develops.
Well, you know, this was one of the advantages we had going into the room pitching this thing, was that the traditional elevator pitch for these kinds of things wasn't something that we ever had to rely on because they'd read the book going in. It's a somewhat complex ensemble that, you know, just unfortunately doesn't lend itself to easy encapsulation.
From my understanding, the main plot is there is a murder. It takes place in Pittsburgh, where the novel is based. There are two characters who are become suspects in this case. They are trying in their own way to clear themselves of the murder and nab the real person who killed. But the twist, of course, is that one of them can be a creature of the night, shall we say, a werewolf.
That is all accurate, yes. And then, you know, like, essentially, the engine of the mystery of who's responsible for these killings is really just, it's a narrative device to explore these two main characters and the major sort of existential / thematic questions of their lives, and then also the deeper secrets and mysteries underlying the town itself and the very peculiar collection of people who are populating it.
Did you have a TV inspiration for this, like a Twin Peaks?
I think that it's difficult to avoid the shadow of Twin Peaks. I mean, nearly impossible, really. But I would say that, you know, this is a situation where there's a difference between correlation and causality, because it just so happens that a lot of the things that inspired David Lynch narratively happened to be the same things that inspired me narratively when I was writing the novel. For instance, we both grew up in relatively small, traditionally American communities. For David Lynch, it was Missoula. For me, it was the greater Pittsburgh area. And in both cases, you have an environment where there is a heavy intersection of natural beauty and the realms of American industry.
So as the episodes go, how do you develop these two sort of parallel lines in your program, one being the two main characters and their effort to clear themselves and to see whether or not one's a werewolf or not, and of course, that direction, that fork in the road, if you will, but also, as you just said, the town itself, how it reacts to everything, what the characters in the town are and how they play off each other.
So when I was writing the book, the elements that I had in place pretty clearly were the main characters and the environment in which they were interacting. And so I actually started writing it without even knowing what the plot was. It just occurred to me that, you know, there needed to be something bringing them together. There needed to be something moving it forward. My own approach to this genre is that the plot is both the most essential and the least essential element. It's really just an excuse to get to know these people, and, you know, it's creating the maximum degree of stakes to rattle their cages.
Brian McGreevy is the author of Hemlock Grove, and next week it becomes the newest series on Netflix on Friday, April 19th. 13 episodes, all available for you on your smart TV set or online at Netflix.com. Brian joins us here in New York this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Happy to have you aboard. 44 degrees at the top of the hour. Still raining here in the Big Apple. And happy to have you with us for our special two-hour edition of the show that covers the world of television. We're here on Blog Talk Radio Mondays and Fridays at this hour. If you have a question or comment for Brian, give us a call, 1-646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Welcome our friend, guest 1281 into the room. Coming up in our next half hour, we'll go back to Los Angeles with more from Michael Netkin, the executive producer of Defiance, the video game, now the television series, beginning Monday night at 9 on Sci-Fi. And coming up next week on Tomorrow We Televise, my guest will be Ross Babbitt. He is the head of programming at Travel Channel. And next Monday night, they've got a mouth-watering, you might say, series premiering called Burgerland. We'll talk about the search for the new hamburger or the best hamburgers around this country and other TV series in the works of Travel Channel, Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. What was it like to work with Eli Roth? What kind of a director as well as a executive producer is he?
He was very instrumental in defining the style of the show. He's someone who he has so much energy, no shortage of ideas. And like I say, because my experience has been pretty much exclusively on the page, I'd say, you know, he very definitively put his stamp on the series.
Now, I read somewhere that you wanted to film this program in Pittsburgh, but because of a situation involving the city, you had to move it up to Canada. What happened?
That was a very unfortunate situation that came down to sort of immovable objects versus irresistible force, because what ended up happening, and I'll try to simplify this as much as I can because my own understanding of it is tenuous, is that for really obscure procedural reasons, the state of Pennsylvania couldn't guarantee our rebate in time for the production to start, and the bank could not release the cash flow without the state's guarantee. And so, you know, it really was very sad, because if it had been a couple of weeks different, we would have been able to shoot in Pittsburgh, no problem. But, you know, as it happened, we had to pull up stakes and move to Toronto. We did manage to get at least second unit in Pittsburgh, which was very crucial to me.
And then ultimately,
as a piece of trivia, we ended up changing Pennsylvania state law. They altered their own statutes after this to make sure that the same thing didn't happen again.
So Brian, if the series does go into season two, will you make another effort to get it back in Pittsburgh?
You know, if I'm being perfectly honest, that's a decision that's made a couple of levels above my pay grade.
But it's nice to hear that that the state law got changed so they will allow more film and TV production in the state, and like the same thing in New York and other states around the country.
Well, Pennsylvania is a great place to film, and this is a situation, you know, for instance, if it had been a movie studio production, it wouldn't have been a big issue, because movie studios are willing to take on that kind of risk in a way that TV production simply isn't. I mean, you know, the city of Pittsburgh, it has great crews. It has really experienced crews, and it actually has the largest physical studio space west of Los Angeles. You know, they recently shot that Tom Cruise movie, Jack Reacher, there, as well as a significant part of the last Batman movie.
Brian, we have a call. We are going to take it. Hello, you're on Tomorrow We Televise. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, Simon. It's Rick Webb calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And, Rick, you're on the line with Brian McGreevy from Hemlock Grove.
Hey, hello, Brian. First, how you doing? Congratulations on all your success.
Thank you.
I wanted to touch base on, you know, I tried to do a little research on you because I just thought it was amazing that you were able to sell the series before the book was even out. And, you know, I saw that you were on the blacklist with a couple of your screenplays previously. So I sort of wanted to learn about that more beginnings of your career. I mean, how did all this come about? Did you just get, you know, an agent from your screenwriting because it was so good? And that's how you were able to almost, you know, get the series even before the book was even out? It just seems amazing.
Well, so the trajectory in brief was that in graduate school, I started working with my screenwriting partner, Lee Shipman. And so the first script of ours that ultimately did end up on the blacklist was actually my secondary thesis in graduate school. My primary thesis was Hemlock Grove, as a matter of fact. And we submitted that script to the Nickel screenwriting competition, which releases, I want to say, all of the people who make it as far as the quarterfinals to movie industry agents and managers to see if they're interested in you know, if they're interested in the script and the contact information. Because, you know, the thing about these screenwriting competitions, the objective really isn't to win. I mean, like, it's nice to win, but that's really more for it's more for ego purposes than practical purposes. The goal is to get representation out of it. And, you know, good reps are frequently hungry for new talent, with the caveat that they would like it to be vetted to some degree first, which is why all of them scour these screenwriting competitions. And so that was how we got in touch with our manager. Well, he got in touch with us, and we worked pretty hard with him. And he was the one who liaised our relationship with our agents, and then we were just off to the races.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really inspiring, especially myself coming from, you know, Pennsylvania as well, just to see, you know, your trajectory and, you know, and definitely wishing you more future success.
But what I would say, if there's any takeaway that I think that my experience provides, is a realistic sense of timing. So, for instance, we're actually in the process of making a deal for that script, you know, which got us our presentation. And that was, we're literally talking about something, a process that started in 2006.
Wow.
You know, 2006 was the same year that I started Hemlock Grove. And so, you know, there's something very paradoxical about the film industry in that everyone is in love with this fantasy of the Cinderella story that, you know, overnight you're suddenly this great success, when the reality is the majority of success that you see is actually the product of, you know, a good 8 to 10 years of sausage making that doesn't get publicized.
Well, cool. Well, I'm definitely going to be checking out Hemlock Grove when it comes on Netflix. So,
great. And I recommend buying the book in stores now.
Awesome. Okay, well, thanks a lot, and good luck, Brian. Take care.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Simon.
You're very welcome, Rick. Anytime. Take care. Rick Rav, our good friend and often contributor, Brian, from the great state of Pennsylvania, like you, in Philadelphia, in this case. Brian, your show was previewed earlier this week at MIP. That is the famous International Programming Fair in Cannes. Have you heard any feedback from them? I've heard that your screening had quite a bit of audience reaction.
You know, I've been so busy with the various things, I haven't had an opportunity to check in. As said, I was catching up with Bill Skarsgård last night, but he has been traveling so much. He was really under the weather with a bad cold during MIP, and so he actually had to sit out the majority of it.
Well, I bet to him. Hopefully he's more on the weather as we speak. Have you already thought about how you will do the series in a season two?
There have been preliminary but thorough discussions amongst the creative executive producers on that very subject.
And what do you think about the impact Netflix has had, not only on how television series get made and produced, but the sense that we may be on a revolution here in terms of seeing more talent coming to television in a quicker way, as well as more ways to get a television series on the air the way creators want it?
I mean, I would say that when it comes to the actual impact that what Netflix is doing will have on the industry, that we've maybe seen 1% of it. You know, like, I see it as a situation, you know, somewhat like Facebook, that, you know, Facebook certainly wasn't the first social networking site. It was just the first one to maximize the degree of elegance and therefore place in the market. And so, you know, this was always going to happen. It's just a question of timing, and I think the innovative thinking on the part of Ted Sarandos that makes them the first dominant player in what I believe is absolutely a revolution. I think that this landscape is going to be completely unrecognizable in, you know, 10, 15 years.
Ted Sarandos, by the way, is the chief content officer for Netflix, and I had a chance to meet him some months back, and he is definitely a mover and a shaker in the TV world. Before I let you go, Brian, talk about your actors. Anybody you see being a breakout star out of this?
Again, I think that we're going to see great things out of both Landon and Bill. on this project and whatever they pursue in the future. Working with Fonka and Dugray was a pleasure. These are guys who are quite professional. They know their way around. They really make the process easier for everyone involved. It was a delight working with Lily Taylor. I would say one actor to keep an eye out for. I think he has the potential of becoming a breakaway in his own way is a gentleman named Joel De La Fuente, who plays the character of Dr. Johann Price. I know that he delighted all of us, and I hope that he delights the audiences as well.
I agree. I've seen his work on Law & Order SVU and on some of the other Law & Order programs. He's going to play this in a fairly supporting role, and always liked him there, and I agree with you. I think he is going to be a breakout out of your series. Hemlock Grove, 13 episodes, debuts a week from today on Netflix. And it will be available both on your smart TV set, if you have it, or you get it on your personal computer at Netflix.com. And that's where you can go on the web to find out more information about the series and Netflix as a whole. Brian McGreevy, the author of Hemlock Grove, the series creator and executive producer, thank you for joining us. Good luck with the series next week, and hopefully it will run for many, many years.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Take care.
You too.
Brian McGreevy, author of Hemlock Grove, joining us live here in New York on Tomorrow We Televise. When we come back to Los Angeles, our second interradio exclusive of the hour with Michael Nankin, executive producer for Sci-Fi's new series, Defiant. It premieres next Monday. Also, the answer to our classic trivia question of the week on NFL Monday Night Football, and we have a winning answer. We'll have it all right after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is a place to discover what the world has to say. www.blogtalkradio.com, more than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for King Jordan Talk. Catch it tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Don't forget, you can catch the best of BTR 24/7 at youtube.com. Welcome back to Tomorrow We Televise. Welcome to those of you just joining us at the bottom of the hour. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York, special two-hour edition today. We've got three more great guests coming your way over the next 90 minutes. We invite you to be part of this program. All you got to do is join in the conversation with a phone call and with your question or comment at 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. Or get involved with our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. We welcome guests 1315, 1318 into the room. Either way, love to have you involved because what you say matters. Back to Los Angeles we go, rejoining us again from our first half hour, one of the executive producers of Sci-Fi's new series, Defiance, premiering Monday night, Michael Nankin. Michael, how big do you think this series is going to be, not only as a way for video games and TV to be linked in a major connection, but also in terms of what some people call immersive interactive storytelling?
Well, I think, it remains to be seen. We'll know next week and in the following few weeks how well we've anticipated the appetite for that out there. But I think that, if we are successful, you'll be seeing quite a bit of this rather soon. And I think that if we're not successful, you'll be seeing quite a bit of it, but farther down the line. I think it's a rather bold and intelligent pairing of media.
As a matter of fact, Michael, when Dave Howe, the head of Sci-Fi, was speaking at a presentation Wednesday night, he made it very clear, both directly and indirectly, between the lines, that from here on in, starting with your program, every new show on his network is going to have some form of viewer interaction, whether it's through a video game, social TV, a smart television application, a video chat kind of thing. Does that sort of magnify the impact the series could have for you?
I'm still wrestling with this whole idea. I heard an interview, a program on NPR the other day that talking about how many screens people have going at once, and the average was 3. A TV, an iPad, and a phone, or a TV, a computer, and a phone. And so I think Dave Howe is absolutely right. It's the future. There's actually an app. There's a Defiance app for your iPad, which will use the microphone of the iPad and listen to the TV and sync itself up with the broadcast so that as a scene will play, the app will offer behind-the-scenes photos and stories and, extra material Now, part of me is very excited by this, and part of me is the director. Part of me is horrified because I want you looking at my shots.
And it just seems, Michael, that this is a huge bet for a television network to take. And if sci-fi is guessing right, that we the public are ready for this kind of immersive entertainment in a major way, you wonder what the consequence will be for any other television network, whether it's CBS or USA or HBO or Showtime.
Well, I just, you know, my hat's off to sci-fi and Trion. I guess my hat's off to Comcast, which is their owners. You know, to be first, it's a big gamble. It's a very, very expensive gamble, and they've got a lot of money riding on it, and they've got a lot of prestige riding on it. And, you know, I always admire courage in this business. So it's really exciting being a part of that. And, yeah, you know, as I said before, if this takes off, you're gonna see it everywhere.
You're not the only person in recent days that's mentioned Courageous at that sci-fi event here in New York, which ironically was on the set, the former set of Law & Order at Chelsea Piers. Ron Moore, the executive producer of Battlestar Galactica, the revival, went off the teleprompter and basically said the same thing. Here's a network that's very courageous. We don't often say or give television network executives credit for being courageous in television, but sci-fi is one of those networks that does it regularly, that they'll give creative freedom to people, and they'll also be very courageous and stand by them no matter what.
Yeah, I have to second that. I worked with Ron on Battlestar, directed quite a number of them, and even, you know, at that level, had an enormous amount of freedom. So yeah, there's a lot of courage going on over at sci-fi.
In Defiance, it looks like you have sort of two interesting plot lines in play. One is Earth being rebuilt from an apocalypse, and second, this effort by an alien race to colonize it, and the sort of clash that happens between the two societies. How did you get to that point of making it a sort of double play series?
Well, let me kind of rephrase what you just said, because that's not quite exactly it. You know, Defiance begins, the series begins 30-some-odd years after these aliens have shown up in orbit around Earth in their arcs, you know, and they're all from different planets. They don't like each other. They don't get along. But they've thrown together to save their lives because their sun went nova. And they've come here sort of knocking on our door saying, what do you say, guys? You have some extra space for us. And, of course, everyone on Earth has a different opinion. All of the aliens have a different opinion. And so war breaks out, you know, inter-human war breaks out, inter-alien war breaks out, and then war between the aliens and the and humans break out, and goes on for 20 years until Earth is, you know, no longer recognizable because it's been partly terraformed by alien technology. Their ships are all destroyed, and, you know, half the population of both sides is dead. So there's no the idea that they want to colonize us is long given up, and Defiance begins at a point where it's a matter that cooperation is a matter of survival, that war will destroy everybody, and the humans and the aliens and the factions within each side have to look at each other and say, if we're going to survive and if we're going to have children and they're going to survive, we have to work together. So there's no fixing the Earth. The damage is done. It's half, you know, filled with alien plants and animals. And there's no colonization. There's no going back to the aliens until everyone's forced, you know, to join hands. And the tension, the dramatic tension of the series, will be: can we do it? Can we grow up? Can we abandon our ideas of selfishness? And where do our new loyalties lie? And everyone has to reexamine their priorities to survive.
And I guess that within that framework, there's a lot of current issues in our world that you can certainly realize in sci-fi terms.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sure you've heard other people say this. It's an immigrant drama. You know, we could take the storylines and the characters from Defiance and set them in, you know, New York in 1900. And instead of spaceships, they're coming through Ellis Island. It's all the same dynamics.
Defiant
very
premieres
American,
Monday.
Very
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Story.
Go ahead, Michael.
And being that way, it's a very American story. You know, it's about emotionally our a long history of immigrants and people from different walks of life and with different ideas about how life should be lived, coming together and having to make it work and the struggle that involves.
Sci-Fi premieres Defiance, the TV series, this Monday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. Michael Nankin is one of the executive producers. He is live with us for an InterRadio exclusive interview on Tomorrow Be Televised from Los Angeles. Simon Appledown, the other coast, New York, here on Blog Talk Radio. Happy you're with us on this Friday afternoon, and we invite you to be part of the dialogue. All it takes is you calling us with a question or comment. The number you use is 1-646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Coming up our next half hour, we'll go live to Denver, and we'll hear about what is one of the sleeper series of this year so far on the Weather Channel, Prospectors. And we'll talk to executive producer Sarah Presta. And coming up, and also in that hour, we'll go live to Toronto, Canada, and we'll hear about a network that you might not know about, but it's serving a lot of people who fish for sport or for their business. World Fishing Network. Program Director Anna Rodriguez joins us live from there. That's coming up in the next hour, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Tell us about your cast and how they are. Have any of them done science fiction acting before? And if so, was there any sort of adjustment they had to make in terms of doing a science fiction series?
First of all, I can't even begin to talk about our cast without using the word love. The most delightful, hardworking, lovely, talented cast that I've ever seen. We just got incredibly lucky on this, and we formed a family out in the wilds of Toronto this last summer and fall during the shooting of this. But more specifically, to answer your question, I don't quite know what sci-fi acting is. I mean, it's as we did on Battlestar, what we endeavored to do on Defiance is that the scenes are scenes. You know, whether they're set in an alien world or a human world or a spaceship or in the locker room of a police precinct, the drama is the same, you know, if it's well written. And so really my job is to help the actors not do anything different than they would on any, well written drama. What they did have to face on Defiance is working in a green screen environment. There's quite a bit of the Defiance world that we were able to build, but some of it which we couldn't and had to be built with computer-generated images. So we would, show up on a giant stage surrounded by green felt or green fabric, and we would have the actors, and we would have the floor, and we would have like a table and chairs, and everything else had to be imagined. So it requires quite a bit more invention from the actors and the director and everyone around to anticipate what's going to be in the frame with them and how they can react to it.
How long away has green screen come, Michael, from when sci-fi first used, in fact, TV first used in a show called Sanctuary with Amanda Tapping?
It's come a long way. I mean, I started quite a number of years ago back in the, in the primitive days where you couldn't move the camera, to now you can. I've done, long, handheld, the most complex moves imaginable on green screen without even having to think twice about it. As you watch the clients, there's quite a bit of storytelling that goes on in these mines. The town of Defiance is rich with this mineral called gulenite, which was created by the terraforming, the alien terraforming. And there are a lot of stories that take place in the mines, and we did not build an inch of the mines. Everything you see in the mines is CGI, and I defy anybody to be able to separate it from reality.
One of the great things about Battlestar Galactica was the diversity, both on and off the screen. On the screen, you had Edward James Olmos in the Adamo role. You had Grace Park, you had Tricia Heffner, Katie Sackhoff, all marvelous talent. And you had great writers who really showcased diversity in a number of ways, both on the screen and also in the plotting of the shows. How about this in terms? How about Defiance in terms of diversity, both on and off the screen?
Well, I mean, we have six alien races. No one's more diverse than that. But the serious answer to the question is, it's something we look for It's something we don't really bend the story to accommodate. But for example, the Meade family in the Town of Defiance, the rich family who is the has the power and runs the owns the mines, are all First Nations, which no one others in the show ever mentions or is aware of. But you know, something that we did because we thought it was appropriate. You know, we try to, it's pretty much a colorblind show. But I also want to point out that our attempts to stay diverse extends to hiring writers, directors, crew as well.
Because of the interaction between the video game people and the and your production crew, how do your writers work with the people who do the video game? Do they have a, is the show in production in terms of time frame enough so that, let's say, as you get feedback from people who play the game and the people who develop the game come up with plots, that you can then incorporate the plots into your program and vice versa? Give me a sense more of the connection process.
The game takes, you know, although the game and the show live in the same world, the game takes place in what's left of San Francisco, and the show takes place in what's left of St. Louis. So we work with, you know, aside from the few crossover characters that go back and forth, the casts and the stories are different. We tried to create as many crossover elements as we could, and this was all new territory for all of us. And we found that, you know, I think the game people needed 90 days to create something that, like, if we had came up with something, we needed them to put it in the game. They had a 90-day lag before they could design and animate and actually drop it into the game. And, you know, we had our limitations as a television production. And so we really, you know, learned by doing along that process. We found that there were things that in the design elements, you know, there were things that they could do really well that we couldn't, and vice versa. Like the whole issue, early on we talked about having horses. You know, it's a post-apocalyptic world, and a lot of the technology is broken, and we thought, well, you know, why don't we have horses pulling carts? But the game people said, that's just too, you know, that's too difficult for us. You know, we're going to end up putting way too much of our resources into creating CG horses in our game. So we dropped it. And, you know, so it sort of went like that. We would just stay in constant touch. We had actually two employees on the show who had no other job other than to keep the game and the show lined up so that we weren't going down a road they couldn't handle and vice versa.
Do you think it will reach the point where your writers will write for the game and vice versa, that, let's say, the people writing the video game or dictating the actual actual write a script? Do you think we'll get to that point?
I don't see why not, you know, although I'm just hoping that our writers are too busy to work on the game. We're just making too many TV shows. It's a different, I mean, it's weird. It's a different world. It's the same job, but the way it is now is that there are game writers and there are TV writers. There's no real reason why they shouldn't flip back and forth. It just doesn't happen very often.
Michael Nankin is one of the executive producers of Defiant, the TV series based on the video game that just came out earlier this month. That premieres Monday night, 9 p.m. Pacific time on Sci-Fi. Michael joins us live from Los Angeles. Gator Radio exclusive, second of two this hour on Tomorrow We Televise. We're happy to have you with us. Simon Appleband with you live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. And we invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call at 1-646-652-2906. Or you have a question or comment, you're a little shy about using the phone, use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. We welcome guests 1315, 1318 into the room. Coming up at the top of the hour, we will have Sarah Presta. She is the executive producer of one of the sleeper TV new series this year, Prospectors on the Weather Channel. She will join us live from Denver. Michael, how does the experience of doing this show compare with what you did on Battlestar?
It's very similar in all the best ways. I'm working with people who are delightful and immensely talented, And on both shows, I woke up every morning looking forward to going to work. On both shows, I worked with crews who worked harder than anyone I've ever seen, dedicated to the project. And on both shows, I had very, very high-quality scripts to work with. So, it's, you know, for me, it's a dream come true.
So I worked with Kevin Murphy. I met him at the sci-fi presentation Wednesday night, and like you, he's got fingers crossed.
Oh, yeah. We're all, like, we're all biting our nails. Kevin's one of the great showrunners in the business, and I learn something from him every day. He's an amazing artist and manager, which is a rare combination. You know, he can not only create things that are magnificent and unexpected, but he gets people working at their highest capacity and happily for him, and is able to, you know, and stays on good terms with the network and the studio and everyone involved. It's really, he's sort of like a great, you know, sort of orchestra conductor of all the personalities and egos involved in the process. It's quite wonderful to watch.
And talk more about your cast. One of the people that folks may recognize is Julie Benz, who was so wonderful in Dexter, which is going into what may be its final season on Showtime this fall. But talk about the cast and what they bring to the table.
Well, Julie, as you mentioned, the first time I saw her, I thought she was I'm going to have a senior moment because I'm trying to reach for another name. I'll have to come back to that. I can't think of the other actor I was going to compare her to. What we found, you know, what I found, because I was the, you know, Kevin was the creative head here in L.A., running the writing room and the editing room. And I was the creative head in Toronto running the set. And what I found with almost all our cast, you know, Julie, Grant Bowler, Mia Kirshner, Jamie Murray, Tony Curran, was that they could all handle anything. And, you know, from the beginning, I kept calling up the writer's room saying, like, guys, give them more. They are so capable. They have so much to give, you know. Like, just, you know, they will never disappoint you no matter what you write. And so it was really a matter of trying to let these people shine. I mean, I felt like I had a fleet of Formula One race cars, and I wanted them all to go 100 miles an hour all the time.
I met Grant on Wednesday, and he is one of those actors that if you don't know him by name, you may know him by face because of other performances, but I think you'll get to know him by name and face as of Monday night. You also meet Kirshner, who a lot of people remember from L Word, also on Showtime.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Oh, and the person I left out of that list was Stephanie Leonidis, who plays Arissa, who is, I think, going to be the young breakout of our cast. Is, I think she'll be the one that, like, no one ever heard of before, but everyone's talking about afterwards.
What does it say to you that, in part because of your program, that some key Hollywood filmmakers now want to do series for sci-fi, like Robert Zemeckis, like Alan Hurd, who did Aliens, and, of course, does The Walking Dead, that there are now people in Hollywood who think of sci-fi and what you're doing so highly that they want to jump in?
As long as they don't take work away from me, it's all great. We're kind of in a renaissance right now of television sci-fi. There's a lot being developed, not only because I think it's popular, but I think that it's a great storytelling medium.
And the technology, as you mentioned with green screen, has evolved to the point where basically you can recreate any landscape, any world, any, you know, spectacular situation, special effect, literally on the fly, comparable, maybe sometimes better than the movies.
Well, I don't know if it's. I mean, I think that in TV we have a lot of ideas that are better than many movies. Technology, we have the same technology. The advantage movies have over us is time. You know, they will take a CGI shot and massage it for 5 months, you know, and put on version, you know, the version you see is version 38, whereas we have the same equipment, the same talent, but, you know, we have to show you version 4 because we don't have the time.
are you still shooting episodes of Defiance, or is everything pretty much done for hopefully will be the first of many seasons?
Yes, hopefully the first of many seasons. We just we're just finishing wrapping up the final touches on the last episode this week. So post has been fairly extended, and you know, we've had the advantage, much like Hemlock Grove, the advantage of completing all 13 episodes before any of them aired. So we were able to go back and take things that we learned from shooting episode 11 and 12 and apply them back to the pilot and sort of re-engineer the pilot a bit so that the whole series feels holistic, you know, and of one piece. Often, you know, by the time you get to the end of the season, you've already aired four or five of them, can't go back and touch them. So this has been a great opportunity for us.
And does the connection with the video game also allow you to do the same thing? For example, let's say we find out over the next couple of weeks there's a particular character or plot line that the video game people and viewers are so attracted by that you can maybe highlight that or emphasize that in an episode that is yet to run on Sci-Fi.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, exactly. We're anxiously awaiting, you know, the knowledge we're going to gain from 6 months of gameplay. You know, we did the first season without knowing anything. Now we're going to know what people are attracted to and what dynamics work, and you know, so we'll be able to go into season two as like seasoned veterans.
The adventure of Defiance, the TV series, begins next Monday night, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on Sci-Fi. Check your local listings for where the network is available in your area on cable and satellite. And for more details about the show online, Sci-Fi, that's SYFY.com. And, of course, Defiance, the video game, is available at a video store near you, GameStop, other locations around the country. Michael Nankin, one of the executive producers of Defiance, thank you again for joining us. Congratulations on getting this show off the ground. And hopefully this is the first of many, many seasons. And hopefully, as well, this could be the beginning of a major new and spectacular direction for television. And we really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you for keeping the radio alive and vital.
Thank you. We try here at Blog Talk Radio. It's a wonderful way to showcase all kinds of radio in all kinds of ways.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Same here, Michael. All the very best. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Michael Nankin, executive producer of Defiance, joining us live from Los Angeles. And now it's time for the answer to this week's classic trivia question, and we have a winning answer at that. The question was very simple. Name the original play-by-play sportscaster of NFL Monday Night Football back in 1971. Well, some people who emailed and responded to that question said, naturally, Frank Gifford. And that is not the case. Yes, he was on the original first season of Monday Night Football, but as a commentator. He wasn't the play-by-play person. Well, Linda Hoyt of New York did come up with the correct answer, and it is Keith Jackson. Yes, Keith Jackson, who would later become the voice of ABC College Football for so many years, was the original voice of NFL Monday Night Football in his first season, and then switcheroo time, Keith went to college football, Frank became play-by-play for so many years, and became the longest-running play-by-play person in NFL Monday Night Football history. So the answer to our classic trivia question this week is Keith Jackson. And thank you again to Lynn Hoyt of New York for her correct answer. We do appreciate it. We'll have another classic trivia question for you on the show Monday. And if you have the answer, or if you have a question you want to stump our Blog Talk Radio audience with, let me know. Email me at simonapple04@yahoo.com. simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please enclose your name and where you're emailing from. And, of course, if we use your question on the air, you get the credit. And if you're the first one with the correct answer, we'll highlight you on this program next week. Remember, if you missed the question, you can catch up on my Facebook page or my Twitter hashtag that's at UBC Simon TWBT. That's at UBC Simon TWBT. This is Tomorrow We Televise. We are the internet radio show that covers the world of television with you Mondays and Fridays, 15 Eastern and Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Coming up a week from today, TBS has a new comedy premiering next week. It's a game, it's a prank, it's both. It's called Who Gets the Last Laugh, hosted by Donald Driver of Scrubs fame. Executive producer Jason Goldberg will be my lead guest. And then we'll introduce you to maybe the most unique music video network around. It's called Zing. And we'll have Kanika Chatta, the programming manager of that service, with us. That's all a week from today, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to our homepage anytime. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. You can also do a podcast. Download it to your smartphone or tablet at iTunes.com. Coming up in our next hour, we'll highlight the sleeper hit on the Weather Channel, Prospectors, and an interesting channel available in some places on digital cable, others on video on demand, World Fishing Network. We will have the executive producer of Prospectors, Sarah Presta. She joins us live in Denver after we pause at the top of this hour for web identification. You are connected to the place to discover what the world has to say. www.blogtalkradio.com, more than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for variety radio online. And speaking of sci-fi, one of the co-stars of a show just renewed for its fourth season on that network, Being Human, Sam Huntington, is the guest of variety radio. That's tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Congratulations to Sam and all the Being Human cast for their fourth season coming up next year on Sci-Fi. Remember, you can catch the best of BTR 24/7 anytime at YouTube.com. Well, in the second hour of a two-hour Tomorrow Be Televised this Friday afternoon, April 2013, and welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of this hour, Simon Applebaum with you live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, and we invite you part of the program that covers the world of television. Another great pair of guests coming away this hour ahead, and if you have any questions or comments over that 60-minute span, give us a call. The number is 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. The numbers could end where you're catching us across the country, around the world here on BTR. Another way to get involved in our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. We welcome guests 1398 and 1318 to the room. So use the phone, use the chat room. Either way, want to hear from you because what you say matters. And while the program is on the air during this hour, you can have others connected right now by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the banner on your Blog Talk Radio screen, that wonderful Facebook icon somewhere, and then follow the instructions. Other people can hear the show with you right now. Coming up, we're going to hear about a sleeper show, and that sleeper show is called Prospectors. Now, some of you, if you know the term Prospectors, may think about all those grubby Western characters that would appear in movies or TV shows like Death Valley Days, The Virginian, Rawhide, et cetera, et cetera, looking for gold or silver or other treasures with that pan, you know, in the small river or creek. Well, there's a lot more to Prospectors these days than you think. And it has become one of the sleeper shows, not only on the Weather Channel, where it's on Tuesday nights at 9 p.m., but all over the world of television. The show premiered last month, and now joining us live from Denver, the executive producer, Sarah Presta. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Simon. Happy to be here.
How are you doing? And are you surprised at the surprise success that Prospectors is having on Weather Channel a month in?
Well, you know what? I have to say I'm not surprised. I'm thrilled. I think we knew right when we started production that we had something really good on our hands.
Why did you think so? Why did you think you had something good on the hands?
Well, part of it is just we had an amazing group of miners that kind of opened up their world to us, and they were excited and passionate, and what they did was crazy dangerous, and all that is incredibly engaging. Plus, what they find is just astonishing, you know, and so as far as, you know, as a viewer, I want to see what they find, I want to see what dangers they brave, and I want to see, ultimately, are they successful? And really early into production, I knew that all those elements were coming together.
How long had you been thinking, Sarah, about doing a show about this brand of people?
Well, you know what, I came in a little bit late in the process, but to be honest with you, the connection with the Prospectors started in the early 2000s when one of Heinen's partners, Sonny Hutchison, actually did a video with Steve Brancato, one of our main prospectors. And Steve had found one of North America, no, it is actually, North America's biggest aquamarine find ever. And so Sonny did a video with Steve for the Denver Nature and Science Museum. And then that was kind of a little germ of an idea for years and years and years. And then our development department at High Noon started looking into, well, what interesting worlds haven't been explored? And, you know, this was in High Noon's own backyard.
When you came to the table to do this, did you have a sort of stereotype or an idea about what Prospectors are based on, let's say, any Western movies you saw or American history?
You know, I think it was with everybody else that I'm like, God, people really do this. They still do this, and they can do it for a living, you know? I mean, I think all of us as kids, you know, were interested in, like, geodes and the pretty polished rocks that you would see at stores and stuff, but I never made the connection that, you know, there's an actual person out there, you know, digging up this stuff and actually making a living at it. I had no idea.
I still think when I heard the term prospectors, and in fact this was a Weather Channel series, it always came back was the Western character, the Walter Brennan or Gabby Hayes-like character who would be at that creek with a pan, you know, trying to get the gold nuggets and, like, you know, talking in sort of a hick kind of tone. You know, yeah, gotta get that gold and then get that, you know, that silver and everything and come back and raise that money.
Yeah, that's true. Our prospectors are certainly modern-day prospectors, if you will, although, Amanda, I have heard her on occasion say, daggummit. But with that, you know, they're educated people, and they know their geology, and they're passionate about it, and, you know, they use the Internet when they're not in the mountain, and, you know, all that good stuff. You know, they are not the typical, well, I guess the stereotypical prospectors of old. What is kind of in the Old West tradition is kind of that do-it-yourself spirit. You know, and, you know, kind of I'm going to not depend on, you know, a corporation or something like that for, you know, my living, if you will. I mean, I think these people are very proud of being able to make a living for themselves off the land.
Does Spunky Plucky come to mind?
Say again?
Does Spunky or Plunky or Plucky come to mind in terms of their attitude?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, they're never say die people, you know. I mean, what they do is really hard work. I couldn't do it. I mean, I can, you know, up on the mountain, you know, you have 50% less oxygen, and just getting up to the claims, you feel like you have worked a full day, let alone, you know, moving the rock and working in higher UV exposure and stuff like that. I mean, what they do, it is a commitment, and they have to love what they do.
Why do they love what they do? What makes them tick as people and as people engaged in this line of work compared to something else?
Gosh, that's a big one. I think all of them, as far as what they've shared with us, is they, number one, either had a natural love of rocks and the outdoors, and a lot of them had mentors when they were kids, and then some of these, of course, are family operations, the Doris family and the Bussey family. You know, they work together. And I think all of it combines with, you know, kind of I want to do what I love. I want to work outdoors. And I think, like Steve Brancato has told me that he would never want to work in an office. That is his idea of hell, you know. And so I think it's a combination of, you know, wanting to work for yourself, loving nature, loving the rocks, and then having kind of a faith that you're going to find something because, you know, they know the geology and it's still a risky proposition.
Prospectors is on the Weather Channel. It's on Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. Sarah Press is the executive producer of the program for company High Noon, and she joins us live from the Mile High City, Denver, Colorado, this Friday afternoon on Tomorrow Be Televised. We're happy to have you with us in this special two-hour edition. We're in hour number two, 44 degrees at the top of the hour here in New York. It is still raining here in the Big Apple. Expect to do so through the end of the day, but we're happy to have you with us. If you have a question or comment for Sarah, give us that call. The number is 1-646-652-2906. Or get into our chat room as guest 41429 and 1398 have done. Either way, love to hear from you because what you say matters. And coming up our next half hour, we'll go live to Toronto, Canada, and we'll meet with the programming director of World Fishing Network, available at 50 million homes around the country, as well as Canada and the Caribbean, Anna Rodriguez. Sarah, how did you find these prospectors? How long have they been in business for?
Excuse me. Well, Joe Doris has actually been mining for 30 years, and I would say none of them have been mining less than a decade. And so basically how we found them was through kind of word of mouth. So we already had a connection with Steve Brancato, and then he, you know, made suggestions as far as, you know, who might be good fits and who might enjoy the process, because not everybody loves being on TV. And from there, you know, we kind of made connections, and the mining world in Colorado, at least, seems to be small, and so everyone seems to know everybody. And so that was kind of a cool connection that we didn't quite anticipate, you know, where they help each other out. And so they were able to recommend people that they thought would be great for the show.
And once you made contact with them, did how long did it take before you were able to convince them, hey, we want you to be on this program, and we're going to do right by you in terms of showing you as you really are, not trying to make out to be somebody else?
Right. That's a good question. I wasn't part of the development process, but I do know when I came in, I think one of their big concerns was actually the not disclosing exactly where their mining claims were, because that, you know, puts them somewhat at risk. And so we tried to be very cognizant of, you know, not you know, disclosing entirely. You know, we would say a general area. And then as far as kind of, you know, the portrayal thing, I think they were open to it. I'm not sure exactly how we convinced these folks to trust us, but they did, and that's a big part of the process. You know, it's a big part of the process. But High Noon also has a good reputation within the television world that they could look at other shows that we've done and know that, you know, we're reputable.
What is a typical work day for these prospectors? And as your cameras focused on them, what kind of themes about their culture, their lifestyle, their attitudes really came out?
Well, first of all, the mining season on some of these claims, because they're at such high altitude, it's a very short season. So obviously this is a show for Weather Channel, and weather is a big determiner on whether you can mine or not. So, for instance, on one of the locations, which is Mount Entero, it's a 14,000-foot mountain kind of in the middle, roughly, of Colorado, and the road is only open roughly July 1st to maybe October 30th. And so, number one, they know that they've got to make hay when the sun shines, right? So once the road is open, and this is, we were not there for the beginning part of the season, the show hadn't started yet, but actually just accessing their claims is tough because the winter spring freeze thaw puts rocks in the road. And so you have to move rocks literally to get your truck or four-wheel drive up the road where you have to, or an ATV, right? And then you leave your vehicle and you're not even at your dig site yet. You know, then you have to climb through talus and scree fields up to, and, you know, probably huffing and puffing because the oxygen level is, you know, really low. And then from there, that's where they start their mining day. So if you can imagine, you know, they have to carry in their food and they have to, you know, bring in all their hand tools. Now, the Doris family is the one mining family that we follow that actually uses bigger equipment like excavators and whatnot. And so their process is a little bit different. But the miners, for the most part, you know, it's pickaxes and gad bars.
What kind of a toll does this process take on the prospectors' families?
Well, I think it depends on the particular family. The Bussey family, for instance, there is Brian, Yolanda, and they have 6 sons. 5 of them mine with them. So it's less of a – physically it takes a toll because it's obviously exhausting what they do for a living – and dangerous, but there is an upside where they're also closer, and they pass on a love of nature, and they're not just not talking to each other while they watch TV in the evening. So I think there's an upside to it. As far as a toll is concerned, I can't entirely speak to that because I think all their families, it seems to me, are pretty supportive of what they do.
How did this program, Sarah, make its way to the Weather Channel as opposed to a network like History, which has done very well with shows like Axemen and Ice Road Truckers,
mm-hmm.
or True TV, which is also very big on this kind of, as they call it, actuality programming, or A&E, which is having a field day right now with Duck Dynasty, which is getting anywhere between like 7 and 9 million viewers a pop.
Right. Well, first of all, High Noon has a previous relationship with Weather Channel that's been great. Last year we did series called Hurricane Hunters, and actually we're in the process of doing season two with that. And with that, I know that Weather Channel has been recently branching out and doing long-form programming that we thought that this would be a perfect fit. So, and we also kind of had a finite amount of time to get the show going because, once again, you know, the mining season is short, and Weather Channel was great in giving us a quick decision so that we could actually get a show on the air in enough production time.
What are viewers identifying with the most, Sarah? It seems that every week the viewership of this program grows. I see your Facebook page. That's growing in terms of likes and people responding. So far, a month in, what are people responding to the most about this group of Americans?
That's a good question. I think a lot of people are just, I mean, again, there's the danger aspect of it, which is really cool and crazy, but I think people are just really into what these prospectors find. I mean, when they pull this stuff out of the ground, it's not just like gold, where, you know, gold is gold, right? But everything that the prospectors find is unique, which is good and bad because, you know, it's not equally, you know, it takes a while to sell, of course. It's not like gold in that sense. But it's thrilling, and that, you know, at the end of the show, you can find out either what the prospector thinks, you know, this is worth, or we have an assessor that comes out, and, you know, that's really gratifying. Plus, I think a lot of the viewers have, you know, a little inner rock hound in them, you know. It's, I think it's speaking to a lot of things.
The sort of like, I wish I was in their shoes mentality. It's quite a fascinating job, but I'd like to, you know, dig for my own gold, if you will, mentality.
Yeah, you know, it's like winning the lottery, except for you earn it.
The old-fashioned way, as John Houseman used to say in those Smith Barney ads. Sarah Presta is the executive producer of Prospectors. It's running Tuesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on the Weather Channel, and she joins us live from Denver, Colorado, the Mile High City, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-646-652-2906 or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Use the phone, use the room. Either way, we want to hear from you. Coming up near the bottom of the hour, we'll have some more thoughts on the death of comedian and television personality Jonathan Winters. You can make a case he was perhaps the wackiest comedian television ever had. Also, thoughts about his wonderful TV career near the bottom of the hour. And coming up on Monday's program, Ross Babbitt, the Senior Vice President of Programming at Travel Channel. On Monday night, their latest series premieres. It's called Burgerland, the search for the best American burgers around. It's also subject of a wonderful new book by the show's host called Hamburger America. We'll also talk about some of the other shows in the works at that network. Ross Babbitt from Travel Channel, Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Let's go to the phones and have a call. Well, hi there again. You're on Tomorrow Be Televised. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Simon. It's Rick Webb from Philadelphia.
Happy to have you back this hour, and you're on the line with Sarah Presta from Prospectors. Go right ahead.
Hi, Sarah. Two quick questions for you. The first one is about the production of the show. Unfortunately, I haven't seen your show yet, but I'm a camera person, so I was just speaking with someone recently out in Colorado that does, like, remote control helicopter camera, you know, camera copters and stuff. I guess my first question was whether you're using stuff like that more and more in production. And then my second question was more just about your career, because it seemed like previously you've done like a lot of cooking shows and stuff like that, and sometimes I film food and all, so I know a little bit about you. But now all of a sudden you're up on a mountain digging for rocks and mining. So it just seemed like your personal career took a huge jump in a different direction.
I know, from cakes to crystals. So with your first question, that's so funny. Yes, we did use a remote-controlled helicopter, actually, to get some of our kind of transition shots to show the mountains. And that was an interesting experience. So if you can imagine, it's bigger than, of course, a toy helicopter where we mounted a small camera. And what we were able to do was get shots that a helicopter couldn't, which was really great. You know, we're lower to the ground, and, you know, we were able to do that. the challenge of doing that at a after a certain altitude is the batteries don't last that long. And so we had to be very careful to get that little helicopter back to safety so it wouldn't crash down a cliff that we could never get it back again.
Yeah, so that would stink.
Yeah.
So, well, but that's good to know. That's good to know about the, you know, because, yeah, the batteries don't last very long on those.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then as far as my career, I have, well, frankly, I've been lucky in the fact that I have been able to do a bunch of different genres. And so most recently, I did a show called Hurricane Hunters last year, which was about an Air Force squadron that flies into hurricanes, which was great. Prior to that, a lot of shows on Food Network. And then, but in my career, I've also been able to do medical shows and follow docs and crime shows. And so, and a lot of that has been thanks to High Noon. So I appreciate the fact that I haven't been pigeonholed in a certain genre, and they can see that I have strengths that can, if not, you know, I haven't done this before, that I have the aptitude and the willingness to learn. And I fall in love with whatever show I'm working on, or else I couldn't do it.
That's awesome. So definitely continued success, and I'm happy to see that you didn't, you know, get pigeonholed into something. You're able to do, you know, exciting stuff up on mountains.
yeah, and as you know, that's the challenge in our career. You know, it's like, well, you haven't done this before. You're like, yeah, but I know I can. I know I can.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, I'll definitely be checking out the show now. And so continued success, and thanks for putting me on, Simon.
You're very welcome, Rick. A pleasure again.
Good luck to you.
Okay. Take care. Oh, thank you.
Rick Webb, our friendly, wonderful contributor live from Philadelphia here on Tomorrow We Televise. And you mentioned the food programming. I know you've done some shows for Food Network. What's happening with that relationship? And for those people who don't know, what are some of the shows High Noon has done for that channel?
So High Noon, we've done a ton. I personally have done a franchise show called Food Network Challenge, which is a competition show that went on for seasons and then had several offshoots. We also did for many seasons a show called Unwrapped. And then alternately, like other shows called Heat Seekers. And there's been actually quite a lot that we've done with Food Network, and they've been, you know, great and growing High Noon. Currently, I don't think we're doing anything with them right now. I think High Noon has been, you know, kind of branching out into other formats, and I guess it isn't an active pursuit right now.
And I was a big fan of Unwrapped, and of course its wonderful host, Mark Summers, who's now behind the scenes more with Restaurant Impossible, which is doing very, very well. That's on, I think they start a new season Sunday night, as a matter of fact, at 10 o'clock on Food Network, as well as on their regular time period of Wednesdays at 9.
Yeah, I love that show.
Me too. Any thoughts about at some point getting into the scripted side of television, as so many reality production companies are thinking either front door or back of their minds?
You know, I can't speak to that. I personally can't say one way or the other. I am not good at scripted. How's that for you? I find I wish I had that aptitude, but I also find that I'm more moved by kind of real stories. And so I don't know. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Given the success so far of Prospectors on Weather Channel, have they given you a go in terms of the second year?
We have gotten some encouraging signs, so nothing official yet, and we're hoping that, you know, that it works out, that we'll get a season two. Keep your fingers crossed for us.
And season one of Prospectors continues next Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on the Weather Channel. Remember that some of the prime time for the Weather Channel can be taken off because of severe weather situations, so you have to watch out for that situation. Check your local listings for where the Weather Channel is available in your area on cable or satellite. And for more details about the program and the network involved online, you go to www.weather.com. It's www.weather.com. And once again, Prospectors, Tuesday nights, 9:10 Eastern Pacific Time on the Weather Channel. Sarah Presta, the executive producer of the program, thanks again for joining us live from Denver. Congratulations on how the show has done so far, and hopefully we will get to know these prospectors and their lifestyle for many more years to come.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. This was fun.
Absolutely. Take care. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
Sarah Presta, executive producer of Prospectors at High Noon, joining us live from the Mile High City, Denver, Colorado. For those of you who missed our first hour, we led off with the news note that Jonathan Winters, the improvisational wacky comedian who headlined variety shows for television in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, did so much more in the medium, passed away yesterday at the age of 87. The news broke earlier this afternoon. Jonathan Winters was an extraordinary talent in television, and anyone who worked with him could probably tell you that. He not only was a great comedian who could work so well in variety show format, did three of them over his career, but he also could do guest shots. He also could be a great guest on a talk show, whether it's Night Show at night or the Mike Douglas Show in the afternoon, and he always brought forth an incredible improvisational wit. Talk about somebody who could be funny in the moment and keep being funny even when breaking up everyone else around him. He had that great gift, and no one else did. You could really make a nominate him for TV's wackiest comedian of all time, and he'd probably win going away. As I mentioned, he did three variety shows, a 15-minute show for NBC in the 50s, from the 7 to 7:30 half hour, 2 years of a variety show hour-long on CBS from 1967 to 69, and The Wacky World of Jonathan Winters, the syndication, sponsored by Chevrolet, which ran local stations between 1972 and 74. And it was interesting that later on in his life, he turned more to guest shots on various sitcoms and did very well, most memorably as the son of Robin Williams Mork in Mork and Mindy. They made an unforgettable pair. And then it was his Emmy Award-winning performance as Best Supporting Actor in the Randy Quaid comedy for ABC, David's Rules, back in 1991. But John...
Hello?
All right, welcome back to the Marvel Televised. I'm Applebaum live from New York. Let's see if we have Anna Rodriguez, the programming manager of World Fishing Network, joining us live from Toronto, Canada, aboard. Hi, Anna, are you there?
Hi, Simon.
There we are. Happy to have you with us. Tell everybody how long World Fishing Network has been around.
It's been around for 7 years. We've been in the States for over 5. And we continue on increasing our distribution throughout the United States, Caribbean, and Canada.
And what kind of programming do you have on the network? Is it just for the people who fish for a living or for fun, or do you try to go after a general audience that, might want to try fishing every once in a while?
It's really for everyone. We have anything for the avid angler. We have something for the weekend angler, the holiday angler, for the beginners, for the advanced. And we really try to run the whole gamut.
Mm-hmm. And how much original programming do you have on World Fishing Network, and how is it, for example, in prime time, how is it formatted?
Right now we have an 8-hour wheel, so whatever airs during the morning will air in prime and then air in overnight as well.
Mm-hmm. Is there a theme night approach to it, or do you do like a checkerboard where you have various types of shows on any given night?
We had theme nights, but we're actually phasing them out, finding that with regards to viewership, it's really better for us if we do more of a checkerboard rather than anything else. So we tend to look at programming prime first and then go from there.
And I believe that in some places around the United States, your network is carried on digital cable and other places on video on demand. Is VOD more prevalent than the digital situation?
So we actually have agreements with eight of the – sorry, I'm so sorry. I don't know who's calling in, but I'll just let that go. We actually have agreements with eight of the top MSOs in the U.S. and all the major MSOs in Canada, as well as a couple of MSOs in the Caribbean. So video on demand is available through those cable operators that we have the channel distributed through.
And what about DirecTV and Dish, as well as AT&T's U-verse and Fios?
We are on Dish. We are on Comcast. DirecTV and Cox are two of the MSOs that we are not carried with yet. And if there are any avid anglers out there listening to the show who want to get WFN and are a DirecTV or Cox subscriber, then they should call up and ask for the channel.
And how long have you been involved with the network?
I've actually only been here since last summer. It's been a short while.
So in the nearly year that you've been there, how have you restructured or structured the programming?
I've started doing a lot of acquisitions really for this past January. That's when we really see the difference. Because I came in halfway through the year, I didn't have a chance to really have a hand in developing what the network would look like for this year. But going forward, we have a lot of ideas and a lot of implementation that we'll be putting for our next fiscal. And, you know, we have major plans for next fiscal. We're hoping that we can get some finalization done within the next couple of months or so to implement some of those plans. At this point, we don't yet know what our resources will be like for next year, but once it is, you know, we have plans to start producing a lot of original productions.
So right now, the majority of your shows are acquired from independent talent, independent producers.
We have six commissioned shows for this past year that three have started airing, and another three will start airing, one in May, one towards the middle of May, and one in June. And for next year, I'm really hoping for 14. The rest of the programming is acquired.
All right, we'll talk about some of the individual shows and how they sort of blend in with the network as a whole in a moment. Anna Rodriguez, the programming manager at World Fishing Network, is available in more than 50 million homes around the country on cable and satellite, here in the United States, also across Canada and in the Caribbean. And she is our guest live from Toronto, Canada, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Happy to have you aboard in our special expanded two-hour edition. Second time we've done it this year. And we invite you to be involved as a participant as calling in at 1-646-652-2906. Just ring us with that number with your question or comment to Anna. That's 1-646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. We'll guest 1506 into the room. So either way, go to chat room. We would love hearing from you. Anna, talk about some of the original programs you've added on to the schedule you just mentioned. What kind of shows are they, and what do they do for the network?
Well, the three that have already started airing, one of them is Beyond the Cast with J.P. DeRose, which talks about the various products that are endemic to the fishing world. And what he does is he has a panel of guests on that test all these products and really give an unbiased opinion of which ones are best after they go through their rigorous testing. And that is a great show because as an avid angler that's out there looking for more information and looking to see which product too is best to buy, that is definitely one of the shows that they should be watching. We have this great entertaining show called Force on Force, which is about the four out of the five branches of the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, and they go head-to-head for bragging rights in their competition show. There is another show that's coming up called Guided with Mark Melnick, And that show will focus on the lives of guides and what they go through and the different people that they have to interact with within their daily lives and the trips that they have to go out with. And he also learns as he's out there talking to them and experiencing that world with them. Another show will be Belize Outdoors, of course, Belize, the beautiful outdoors, the various species and fishing that you can do there, as well as another one called American Fly Guide, which will start in June. With a lot of these programs, you know, not only do they bring a different element and different production value to our network, but they also bring more of an exclusivity and really focus on programs that you won't see anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the new programs that are premiering this year sort of tie in a particular side of fishing with a particular personality. Is that what you try to go for, is to match up personality with the subject matter, a specific subject matter in the fishing realm? And by the way, how do you find these personalities? Where do they come from?
The personalities that we have this year, we've been working with for the last few years, and they, some of them are faces to the network. Really, going forward, what we're trying to do is also really focus on strong characters. The shows that we have right now are focused on anglers who are knowledgeable or who have been around the angling industry for a long time and know what they're talking about and can bring their resources to the network.
You know, fishing is a category of television that was somewhat popular in the 1960s and 70s because of shows like Gadabout Gaddis, The Flying Fisherman, which was a syndicated show for so many years. There was Outdoors with Liberty Mutual. There was The American Sportsman with Kurt Gowdy on ABC that ran for a very, very long time, sometimes far from ABC's Wide World of Sports. How is fishing television now, and how do you make it attractive to a wide general audience? As opposed to other forms of entertainment programming or nonfiction television?
Well, fishing as a sport is really widely known and loved by, you know, over 60 million Americans. There are more people out there fishing than there are playing tennis or golfing. So we have a wide audience that is interested in fishing. It provides an escape for most viewers who can't get outdoors and experience the water, and we provide that as a service. Anything else that we're doing, we're really out there trying to get that out there to try and educate people on the preservation of waters, trying to get people engaged on going out more and fishing. And we have relationships and partnerships with a lot of associations. But going forward, we also recognize that a lot of our shows are mostly episodic. So for the new fiscal, what we're trying to do is create programs that have an overall arc as well as interesting characters and strong characters, but we'll have that overall arc.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that you tape or film your shows all over the country and all over the United States and Canada.
We do. A lot of our shows in the past have been produced in Canada. There are certain benefits to that. Although we, you know, you can't go out in the middle of winter and get a good fishing show. So we understand that. We recognize that. If you've watched the channel, you'll notice that a lot of our fishing shows are done all over the world, Fiji, Baja. We have shows from that are in Norway, Mozambique. So it's really all over the world, which obviously brings back the world and World Fishing Network. As far as productions, we are looking to do them everywhere, right across the U.S., Canada, and if need be, more travel to exotic places.
Given that fish, as well as all other animals, do not perform to a script, they don't perform when you want them to do their thing before the camera, how long does it take to get a fishing show on the air, from conception to actually filming or taping the program to getting it on your network?
That is definitely one of the challenges, in that sometimes the weather does not cooperate or the fish do not cooperate. But we follow pretty much a usual production timeline. So you have anywhere between 3 to 4 months of pre-production. You're out there shooting for about 3 months, maybe more depending on the weather. You come back, you have to edit and post. So really, you're looking anywhere between 9 months, maybe a little longer, sometimes a little shorter. It depends. It really depends on the program.
Anna Rodriguez is the programming manager at World Fishing Network. It's available to more than 50 million homes around the country and Canada and Caribbean through cable and satellite. Some places digital cable and satellite, some cases video on demand. You have to check your local listings for how it is presented in your neck of the woods. And she is live from Toronto, Canada, this half hour on Suave Televised, special two-hour edition, getting ready to wrap up for the day. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Happy to have you aboard on Blog Talk Radio. So if you have a question or comment, get it in now at 1-646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. How did you get involved with the network? What did you do before coming over there?
I've been involved in television for the past 12 years. I used to actually work very closely with programmers to get branded entertainment into various shows, and I worked directly for the network. I've done distribution for channels all around the world, as well as program sales internationally, and I've also worked in bringing in channels from all over the world into Canada, as well as VOD, online, mobile, wireless, you know, the whole gamut of content, bringing it in.
Back in the 1960s and 70s, when we had a number of fishing shows on television, one thing you did not see was diversity. You did not see African-Americans fish on camera or Asian-Americans fish or Latinos fish. Is there anything your network is doing to showcase the diversity of people fishing or involved in the fishing field in some way?
With regards to any acquisitions, you know, I really look at the best program out there. There is a finite amount of quality programming for fishing programs that you have to choose from. Do I have a huge bucket to choose from? Not really. It doesn't matter to me whether somebody is of an ethnic background or not. I'm just looking for the best program that I can put on the air.
I'm just reading the question because we are in a country in the United States where 40% of the people or the potential audience of a network are people of color, and we're going to get that multicultural majority very sooner than we all think. And one of the things that TV is going to have to deal with any network is going to be how do we reflect the majority, the multicultural majority of people in a country on television, both in front of and behind the camera. And I would think that would be something that would certainly be on top of mind at your network as well as any other network around.
And if there are any programs that I find that are excellent and have minorities in them, then obviously I would be more than happy to put them on the air.
And what kind of shows are you developing at your network? Do you want to try things like magazine format? Do you want to try pure documentary shows? And then maybe down the road, do you think a scripted television, a sitcom, or a drama about life as a fisherman, life or fisherwoman, life in the fishing field, do you think might be a possibility?
We have no shortage of ideas for next year. We do have about 14 different productions that we'd like to greenlight. I'm waiting on resources to see what kind of resources I have for next year. So unfortunately, I can't really talk specifics. We are looking for something other than episodic so that a program has a story arc involved in it, has strong characters that will follow the lives of people, as well as maybe focusing in on news, you know, celebrities in the fishing industry, things of that nature.
If this comes across as reading between the lines, I stand on that. Any possibility of a made-for-TV movie? You know, we've had years ago, we had Robert Redford do a film called A River Runs Through It, which was about fly fishing at the core. What about that idea, a made-for-TV movie?
You know, I've looked at movies in the past, And the difficulty there is that I would need rights all across North America and Caribbean, and it tends at the end of the day to not be feasible. If it comes to a point where it does become feasible, then obviously I'll look at it again.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's being talked about more and more is the ability to get sponsors involved in the programming beyond just running messages. Get them involved in product integration, get them involved in post-sponsorship, perhaps even backing a show. Where are things at with advertising? Are you looking at, as a programmer, are you looking at that kind of relationship within some of your programs or to get some of your new shows off the ground?
For each and every show, we do look at product integration and sponsorship. As long as we can create it to be organic to the program, we are open to the idea and welcome it.
And how is advertising doing? Are you finding that it's basically fishing gear, tackle, rods, reels, a franchise like a Bass Pro Shops? Are you finding that general advertisers, whether it's food or packaged goods or cars, are also getting involved with your network?
We definitely have a large amount of advertisers that are endemic to the channel, but there is a lot of interest from non-endemic advertisers. I think they realize that there is a whole group of people out there who are anglers who obviously have to, you know, buy different products and like anyone else. And I think it's a great opportunity for any advertiser to come on the channel.
And what does it look like in terms of marketing and promoting the network? As I mentioned, this is a network that a lot of folks still don't know about, but it has great reach. Over half the nation's television households, the United States television households have it. And, of course, I mentioned you also across Canada, and you've also jumped in the Caribbean. What about, for example, trying to showcase your network in various ways? Let's say an event here in New York, something in L.A., you know, ways in which more people get to know about the network.
We do have a number of events that we schedule throughout the year. We tend to look at, you know, boat shows, fishing shows, anything of that nature. For next year, we haven't finalized plans, and I'm not sure what that's going to look like. Obviously, the more marketing we can do, the better. And really, the increase in recognition is going to come with the increase in distribution. And that's something that our affiliate department is always engaging operators and trying to get a bigger distribution for us with the various operators.
Oh, and by the way, there is a project you're now doing called Ultimate Fishing Town, where you actually have towns around the United States and Canada nominate themselves for being like the ultimate capital of our country for fishing.
We do. It's a fantastic, fantastic campaign, and we find we get lots and lots of nominations. I believe we're up to almost every state in the U.S. and almost every province in Canada, because it is North America-wide, and we'll start the voting soon, so we'll see how these communities all get together and start, you know, getting the votes in to make sure that they win.
When will you announce this year's winner?
Voting will begin, I believe, in about a week or so. So once that's done, you'll have to check back into our website to see when the winner is announced.
And before we reel up our show for the day, what keeps you going in your role as World Fishing Network? What keeps you motivated? What keeps you wanting to do your best?
I think it's just really the content. You know, anytime I find something new and exciting to put on air, it just gets me excited again. And, WFN is a small company, and I have my hand in a lot of different buckets. And that's something that's definitely engaging throughout the company. Great amount of people to work with. And it's exciting to come to work every day.
Well, on that note, time to bring in the reel, bring the fish on the boat, and head for home. World Fishing Network is available in 50 million households plus around the country, in the United States, Canada, and the Caribbean, on digital cable and satellite. In some places, on a digital basic tier. In other places, on video on demand. So check your local listings not only for whether the network is available in your area, but how. For more details about the channel, which runs 24/7, here's where you go online, www.worldfishingnetwork.com. WorldFishingNetwork.com, www.WorldFishingNetwork.com. Anna Rodriguez, the programming manager at the network, thanks again for joining us. All the very best for the channel. It's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Simon.
Absolutely. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Anna Rodriguez, programming manager of World Fishing Network, joining us live from Toronto, Canada. Coming up Monday on Tomorrow Be Televised, the senior head of programming at Travel Channel, Ross Cloud, is with us. His network has a new show about burgers. It's called Burgerland. It premieres Monday night at 9 p.m., and he'll be here to talk about that and other new shows coming up at his channel. Then next Friday, Jason Goldberg, the executive producer of the new TVS series, Who Gets the Last Laugh, starring Donald Driver of Scrubs fame, and Kanika Chadha from the music video network Zing. That's all next week, Monday and Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you to all my guests for a great 2 hours and all of you for listening. If you missed any part of the program, you check out our homepage at www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. And what do you think about our show today and about our guests? What do you think about the world of television? What's your thoughts of where this media is going? We'd love to hear from you always, so email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please enclose your name and where you're emailing from. You can also check out my Facebook page or my Twitter hashtag, at UBCSimonTWBT. That's UBCSimonTWBT. And also, for more commentary about the world of television, check out my columns at www.mediabizbloggers.com and www.shellypalmer.com. Available to you at those websites 24/7. Remember, we enjoy hearing from you because what you say matters. The views presented on this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associates are Amy Domestico and John Sweet. But tomorrow will be televised. I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a great rest of your day and enjoy your weekend. We'll catch you back here Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio. Until the next time, stay well. And stay tuned.